From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. With U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in Moscow, having met with Russia's President Vladimir Putin and Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, and a pair of marathon sessions at the UN Security Council over the situation in Syria, we have our weekly conversation with BlackAgendaReport.com columnist Margaret Kimberly. Her column this week, Trump joins Democrats in the war party. Margaret, a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don.
So Trump joins Democrats in the war party. At least that's true on its face. A lot of stuff in the back room yesterday, I'm sure, and with President Xi last week. But the media has proclaimed that Trump has joined the war party, and they're happy as hell about it.
Well, they are. The Democrats are happy. The media are happy. He couldn't get arrested by the New York Times or the Washington Post, but they're singing his praises after he launched the missile attack on a Syrian airbase last week. This was less than a week after he said, or Tillerson said, and Nikki Haley said, his foreign policy team, that removing Assad from power was no longer a priority. And they both said so. They were not ambivalent about it at all. Then a couple of days after they make those statements, which are obviously helpful to Assad, there was a chemical weapons attack in Syria against civilians. And the media immediately started saying that Assad had done it. And it was, there was no evidence that a Syrian army carried this out. The White Helmets said, and then the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. Now, the White Helmets are not a neutral body. They're an anti-Assad force. They are linked to al-Qaeda. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is also anti-Assad, and despite the grand name, is apparently one guy living in the UK.
Right.
But anyway, so it's the usual. The White Helmets say, and Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says, and the press picks it up uncritically, and there are, of course, and there was some sort of attack, and there are pictures of dead children and suffering parents, and so we're told that it was Syria, and that means that Assad must go. So now the Trump administration sounds just like the Obama administration. Assad must go. This missile strike didn't apparently do much damage. They informed the Russians about it, who of course informed the Syrians, and there were very little aircraft damage. There were casualties, I believe 20 people killed. And so here we are with a president just as committed to regime change and the imperialist agenda as Hillary Clinton would have been. So in foreign policy, we've gotten no change whatsoever. And I gave my piece that title because I believe that, far be it from me to claim to be a mind reader and say I know what Donald Trump thinks or feels or wants, but he talked often enough. He spoke often enough of a change in foreign policy, a change in relationships with Russia, for me to think that he meant it. That's probably what he wanted to do. And I will hasten to add that having said that does not make me a Trump supporter. I am just stating an observation about him. So I think that is what he wanted to do. But the attacks against him have had the desired impact. He has been under attacks beginning during the campaign. Hillary Clinton, one of the reasons she lost was that she made this centerpiece of her campaign that he was Putin's puppet. This is something I think that the 60 million people who voted for Trump obviously didn't care about. He was under Russian influence. It carried on throughout the campaign. When she lost, they ratcheted up even more those charges as a way of two things. It deflected blame from the Democrats, from because they were defeated when they should have won. And it also allows them to get the interventionist imperialist president that the Democratic Party and part of the Republican Party wants as well. So for the first time, Lindsey Graham and John McCain are smiling. Hillary Clinton said it was something he should do. Bernie Sanders says that Assad must go. He kind of waffles and weasels, and we can't do it unilaterally. But he says the same thing, in essence, that Assad obviously did this, and the United States has to get him out. So there are those of us who are questioning whether or not this was true. And obviously, this made no sense for Assad. Every time there's a report of a chemical weapons attack in Syria that's blamed on Assad, it always happens at a time that doesn't make any sense. Back in 2013, the chemical weapons attack that was blamed on him happened the very day that UN inspectors, chemical weapons inspectors, showed up in Syria. So now we're told that at the moment when there was a president, a U.S. president in office who said that getting Assad out was not his major goal, that his forces were winning, then Assad would take this chance and use chemical weapons, which, by the way, were turned over to the United Nations. Russia brokered the deal. People are saying that Russia lied or Russia was incompetent. It was the United Nations who actually did the work of removing chemical weapons and destroying them. And chemical weapons is not something you can hide easily. This is something that requires infrastructure. So if they say that he didn't have them anymore, he didn't have them anymore. Conversely, the forces fighting against him do have chemical weapons and haven't given them up and don't have a seal of approval from the UN. And they had the motive and the means to carry this out. There's also the possibility that Syria bombed a building that contained chemical weapons held by the opposition forces, and that caused this incident to take place.
And that, in fact, is the scenario that both the Syrian government and the Russian Ministry of Defense have laid out as the most likely. You know, there's so much here. We've been instructed, certainly over the last 8 or 9 years, if not for the entire history of the United States and perhaps of what they call European culture, in the difference identified in philosophy finally in the 19th century between the apparent and the essential. In other words, there's this virtual reality that is the consensus held by everyone that's discussed publicly. That's the narrative and all of that. And then there's what's actually happening in the real world. An example of that is the Nobel Peace Prize winning president who goes global with warfare in Africa and the Middle East and everywhere else that they could put either a boot on the ground or a spy. You know, we may well be looking at that now. There are many contradictions, not just in the narrative coming out of the White House, because, again, we've heard Tillerson back off the Assad must go narrative to balance back and forth. Assad must go, and the Syrian people will decide that at some point, etc. There's whatever actually is happening in the conversations between Tillerson and Putin and Lavrov, which, for all of Tillerson's background, you know, as a, you know, head of fossil fuel, you know, planet eating machine and all of that, I at least had a sense yesterday that the grown-ups were finally talking about this stuff with Tillerson sitting with Lavrov and Putin. And you know, so we don't know exactly what's happened other than the simple facts, such as the there was apparently, and this is, again, apparently, because there haven't been any forensics done yet, some sort of release of toxic chemicals that killed people in that Syrian town. There was also, apparently, and there's an agreement that this happened, an air raid that was simultaneous with that, conducted by the Syrian Arab Army's air forces. And the competing claims presentations at the United Nations last Wednesday, Friday, and yesterday, where the Russian side and Syria said, look, we don't control that territory. Send in the OPCW, people, you know, the Organization for Prevention of Chemical Weapons. Send the crew in there. Tell your boys on the ground to let them in and do a forensic study. And instead, the U.S., France, and U.K. insisting on putting a resolution through that doesn't do any of that, but instead condemns the Syrian government and seeks some sort of action against them. We have also the various statements that certainly look like walkbacks from the campaign promises by Trump, Nikki Haley, Tillerson to a degree, Sean Spicer, etc. And to me, the most interesting part, which is also the turning point of your piece, which is this guy who was elected last November that the, you know, entire civilized world, quote unquote, was terming, you know, the reincarnation of Adolf Hitler, that 2016 was 1932 or 1933, yeah. That this Hitler guy all of a sudden is okay because he blew somebody up. And so, you know, I don't know. I don't think Hitler got quite the same good press, you know, after he invaded Poland or annexed part of Czechoslovakia or whatever. But suddenly everybody's willing to play ball with Trump. He's acting presidential. And I guess there's certainly a lot of truth in it that he acted presidential because he bombed somebody, because that's one of the essential characteristics of the previous 44 presidents of the United States.
Yes.
You know, I want to get to the, you know, what may actually be happening on the ground, but I want to start though with the question cui bono, which, you know, we know Latin for whose benefit. It's a key forensic question in legal and police investigations by looking at motive. Who benefits from this? And as you laid out, Syria's government would not go through 6 years of fighting a war on its own territory, finally have the president of the United States say, you know what, the Syrian people can decide who their government is, and then decide to bomb a target with no strategic military value whatsoever with chemical weapons to kill 20 civilians, no military apparently, and get the entire world to come down on them. It doesn't make any sense. It does make sense for the people who control the territory, who are fighting that government and getting their behinds whipped, to do this, which brought the result that we're looking at now. Let's work through that a little bit.
Well, it's really disgraceful. I'm trying to think of a way to write about it, the depth of the lies and the propaganda. If anyone, including a member of Congress, Tulsi Gabbard of Hawaii, is the only member of Congress that I know of who has actually said, let's investigate this incident. Let's find out who carried it out. And the attack on her was immediate. Howard Dean said that she should be, people need to vote her out of office. She was immediately attacked for saying, let's investigate. She didn't say she liked Assad. She didn't say it was okay to kill people. She didn't say he didn't do it. She said, let's investigate it. And she was demonized immediately. So we have this situation where the United States has created this endless human rights catastrophe. The migrants from Libya and from Syria, it is all the fault of Obama foreign policy. And no one says a word against him, but they will make up just out of whole cloth that Assad is a butcher and he's killed 500,000 people. No, the United States cooked this up. The United States and its allies in Turkey and Saudi Arabia, the other Gulf states, Israel, are responsible for all of the suffering in Syria. But instead, they will tell lies and say that Assad would, at this juncture, when things are going his way, would carry out an act that pretty much ensures a political attack, if not a military attack.
And it drew both.
Yes, yes. So it's just incredible to me. And there is no one else. There isn't even any pretense. No, not even a pretense from the corporate media, from anybody, of presenting a balanced view, of letting people speak who say, well, let's question this at the very least. Nothing.
You know, there was a
cute... White Helmet said it, so yep. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said it, and Assad is a butcher, so it's true. And we got the United States has to start killing people. So, but I think Trump, but I do have to say this, Trump was... his administration was talking about what was in effect a partition of Syria. They weren't talking about just walking away. So it was like Obama policy light, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But so here we are in this horrible situation where Trump, I believe, was just basically being threatened with impeachment. I think he turned around. There are investigations in the House and in the Senate. Saying that he and his people were agents of Russia, calls for impeachment, saying there was an act that this was an act of war, already getting people in the mood for some kind of war against Russia. Very irresponsible language. And I think he was told either directly or he got the message. You have to join the war party or you're out. And but it isn't going to end here. If he thought he was, you know, going to get them off his back by sending missiles to a Syrian air base that was already fairly well protected, and if he thinks that's it, he's wrong. So it's not going to end here. They are going to demand that he does what Hillary Clinton said, calling for a no-fly zone over Syria, which means the threat of war with Russia. And... or more the term false flag is tricky. I don't know if it means something didn't happen or it's not what it appears to be, but more attacks like this where Assad will be blamed for acts that are carried out by his enemies. And just to sum up my feelings about Assad, Syria is a sovereign nation. He has a right to protect his nation from attack. And the Syrian people have a right to be protected from attack. And it makes me very angry that people think it's okay for the United States to decide that this or that person must go and have the right to create suffering for millions of people in another part of the world. We do not have that right, not under international law, not under moral law. We do not have that right. So I'm not going to attack Assad because he is defending his country. I think it's very important that there be people around the world who have the ability to push back against U.S. aggression. So I just wanted to say that also.
Yeah. Yeah, and I couldn't agree more. There is another voice that expressed it, who expressed himself a few days back. I think it was on the 6th. Thomas Massie, who's a Republican, actually a Tea Partier, he identifies that way anyway, from Kentucky. He was interviewed by CNN's Kate Baldwin last week about this, and he said that he didn't think that Assad was behind the attack for exactly the reason, you know, that you laid out, that it just made no sense and was pushing for, you know, getting the OPCW people on the ground to do a forensic investigation. And this CNN, I'll use the word reporter as a euphemism for whatever she was actually doing. First, when he said this, she asked, what do you think? Which is the question a journalist should ask. But she kept interrupting herself in the process of doing it to try to impute what he thinks. Like, well, you don't think that. What do you think? And so he laid out, you know, it doesn't make any sense for Assad to do this. It would be a huge strategic error, and he hasn't been making huge strategic errors. So she turns around and says to him, well, look, what you're saying is what the Russians and the Syrians are saying. Do you agree with them or with your colleagues? And it was... The whole exchange was quite remarkable, actually, and really displayed the media's bias on this question. But through all the haze, you know, We had yesterday two sessions of the UN Security Council. This is on Wednesday the 12th. And finally, a veto by Russia of a resolution put forward by the United States and with the you know, full voiced assent of the affirmative assent of the UK and France, again condemning, you know, imputing the attack to Syria. There was a gas attack. The Syrians did it. They killed their own people, and they should be punished. Russia vetoed it. China didn't veto what they said. Well, we could tweak the language of this and, you know, pull that out and push for an investigation, but they abstained. That's being, you know, treated as some big political event. But if you listen to what China's permanent representative said, that was the reason for it. They were playing the honest broker. Bolivia voted with Russia against this, and it, because Russia vetoed it, that was the end of it, and everyone understood that. And then this press conference with Lavrov and Tillerson, which happened after a meeting between Lavrov and Tillerson, and also a meeting between Tillerson and Putin. And whatever happened in the back room there, you know, you can be sure that the material aspects of this were being discussed frankly. That's just, you know, my estimate of Tillerson and Lavrov and Putin and the way they do business. We're looking at, however, a political landscape now where, on the one hand, the media is giving kudos to Trump for bombing something. We know that the administration, it's clear that the administration, in any event, we can deduce with some certainty that they contacted the Russians and said, we're going to blow up this airstrip, get your guys and stuff out of there. We don't want to kill any Russians. And it was done in sufficient advance of the attack for the Russians to notify the Syrians, who also took very light losses. And apparently that includes in terms of essential materiel. They lost some planes, and as a physical count, it was, you know, some substantial proportion of their air force. But in terms of strategic assets, apparently it was a fairly inconsequential raid. And something else is coming out of this. Trump made some reference to the fact that, well, when you bomb an airstrip, you know, it's not really that productive because it can be put back up and running pretty quickly, and that's what happened, but it's not true. And Trump knows that, as somebody from construction, if you blow up an airstrip, say, with barrel bombs, okay, you can't fill in craters on a runway and have the dirt and the materials, the packing materials, settle in a day so that you can put macadam on top of it again. You've got a long period of fill, settle, compress, fill, settle, compress. And so they deliberately didn't take that airstrip out of commission for good, apparently. That's my assessment of it. So with that as context, and that being timed with first the attack taking place while Trump is sitting with Xi in his secure location. Remember, they chose Mar-a-Lago rather than the White House as a venue, which means that Trump knows what's bugged and what's not there, presumably, as opposed to the White House. Xi's sitting with Trump while this happens, and this back channel to, or forward channel to Russia going on, then the attack, the media doing a, you know, turn on 180 degrees on Trump, at least on this issue, and all of the other moving parts, by the way, with respect to the Russiagate thing that have continued. It's a pretty complicated mess to parse through it.
Well, it is, but it's all very, very dangerous. We have a situation where, for example, one of the ways Russia responded, Russia had an agreement with the U.S. to tell them where their planes were. So that there were no accidents, no mishaps, nobody shoots down the other guy. And Putin immediately suspended the agreement. So we have the risk of serious unintended consequences. And these people don't know what they're doing. They can get us all killed. And I'm not exaggerating when I say this. Oh. And yes, they, you know, it's Glenn Ford has a good column about it in Black Agenda Report this week also, And he said something I've thought of. We may go up in a mushroom cloud instead of dying because of global climate change.
That's right.
But this is these people don't know what they're doing. This is the last gasp of capitalism, is for the United States to run the whole world. And so they have to, they think they have, the only way to survive in their system is to take everything from everyone. And Russia, this enormous country that spans, I think, 8 time zones, that spans Europe and Asia, that has China as a trading partner, that is an energy producer, they cannot leave Russia alone as a sovereign state. They want to control Russia too. And they're trying to affect regime change in Russia also. And they're going to screw it up some kind of way. And
Putin said he's not going to allow that. He made an affirmative statement to that effect yesterday. There will be no color revolutions allowed in Russia.
Yes. And I think Putin has been, far from being this crazy man that we have been depicted, he's quite the statesman. And for a long time, even after the United States overthrew his ally in Ukraine, after all the provocations from the West, he always said, spoke of our American partners. He went out of his way to try to talk to Obama. They didn't show this on the press, but during one of the G20 summits, he actually grabbed Obama aside and they'd had a 20-minute talk in a hotel lobby because he was that anxious to remain engaged. But I think that is over now. And they will not let the U.S. slide anymore. But that is very dangerous. They don't really have a choice. Their survival is at stake. But it's the United States that is to blame for whatever happens next.
And finally, looking at the role of the anti-war movement here, which was, in my opinion, unfortunately silent with respect to Trump, or just overtly hostile, as many people were marching alongside the dump Trump people under a banner, block or resist the Trump agenda, without parsing the parts of the agenda that dealt with foreign policy that the anti-war movement should have been supporting and demanding that he deliver on. And now, if you look at the right-wing websites like Oath Keepers and other people, they're the ones that are calling Trump out on a betrayal. You know, he had 65 million votes. Even if only 2% of those 65 million people voted for Trump because of his foreign policy promises, that's 1.3 million. 20% is 13 million. I see no outreach by the anti-war movement to organize those people to say, look, we voted for you because, and we demand that you do it. If you do that, we're with you. And if you don't, we're taking you out. And to me, that seems to be the task that's before the anti-war movement at this point.
Well, yes, Don, I see what you mean. But I think one of the things this shows is how difficult it is. It may be impossible for a president to be allowed to change foreign policy. It just may be, I think, the forces of imperialism, the military-industrial complex, the power of the neocons, I think it's too much to fight against. And the other thing is Trump has too much other baggage for people who are really on the left to back him. And I have to say, now they're right. There were people who say, well, you were naive to think he was ever going to be able to change foreign policy. And I think events have proven that they were correct. So I don't believe that would have been possible. But the anti-war movement has to fight. Our lives are at stake, and they must fight the Democratic Party as much as they fight Trump.
Margaret Kimberly has a weekly column at blackagendareport.com under the title Freedom Rider. We've been discussing this week's column, Trump Joins Democrats in the War Party. Margaret, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.